Welcome to Haunted Hills Podcast, third episode, True Crime from the Brown Coal Mine. If you listened to our podcast on Brown Coal Mine history, you'd have met some heroes and a fiercely independent community. Well, when Haunted Hills looks at crimes, it is an interesting reflection on the past, the values, timeliness, and sense of justice. While patrons are able to play judge and jury, we are not re-adjudicating these crimes. Most of them occurred too long ago for that to be appropriate. However, these discussions create an interesting contrast of values, or consolidation of values. The offences covered reflect the rural nature of our towns, shedding light on some of the people we don't usually talk about, and what is and was considered criminal. Now, to the Brown Coal Mine, which today is known as Yallourn North. Yallourn North had a wide variety of criminals. Many are unknown. Some were more akin to slapstick comedians, and some are serious villains. Even so, no citizen of the Brown Coal Mine ever received a death sentence. Rumour has it some of the Kelly Gang spent time in the hills around Yallourn North while hiding from the police. It has never been proven, just a legend. Firstly, I want to share the rules from 1919. Written in poetic form, as follows, tacked on the camp notice board. Once upon a time, the Brown, we'd hold a shoe party. Get up a dance, sing a song, enjoy ourselves hearty. Alas, those days have passed and gone, and things have got a knock. You mustn't even whistle now, after 10 o'clock. In days gone by, midst dance and song, we'd see the daylight dawning. At 7 a.m. we'd off to work, all sleepy-eyed and yawning. But now it's bed at 8 p.m. to sleep without a rock, for it's a crime if snoring disturbs the camp, after 10 o'clock. I've taught the dog to bark at thieves, or anything that's prowling, to chase the cats and bunnies too, and stop the foxes howling. He woke me up the other night, my word he got a shock, when I made him stop his barking, 'twas after 10 o'clock. The ladies of the camp heard this new rule, most alarming. They seemed to like the lilies droop, and lose their ways most charming. They said there will be trouble yet, we'll better summer frock, if we're to leave off talking, after 10 o'clock. Now, kind friends, take a warning. If insomnia troubled you, don't while away the dreary hours in driving nail or screw, but haste away to Marble Town and try to get the doc to give you dope and get to sleep before it's 10 o'clock. I love this so much. Dope means an opium-based drug, even then. The rules did not seem to have strict observance. There are many parties reported continuing late into the night after this. Maybe someone was just stirring the pot. In 1921, starting in January, the men of the State Electrical Commission went on strike. At the end of January, it was said to have been settled, only for quote-unquote complications to arise in February. The strike continued this way, past March 25th. On this day, a valedictorian social evening was held for Mr. Kenny, who was moving for work to Melbourne. His wife gave the speech in his absence. She gushed. I'm so pleased to see such a happy crowd amid all the trouble. I hope that we'll soon be behind us and that we will return to the cheery community we were before the strike. Thank you all for making this time at the Brown Coal Mine such a happy time. I'm so sorry Mr. Kenny is away tonight. He would have been so happy to have spent this time with you all. They then sung Auld Lang Syne. Bill finished work around 5 p.m. on the 17th of February 1921. On his way home, Edith screamed, Scab, you're taking the bread out of the mouths of women and children. Others say they heard Bill shout back an expletive at her. His cheeks bloomed red as his temperature rose. When he reached his home, men and women gathered, scab, chanting, Scab. He hurriedly fumbled, unlocking the door to his hut. Scab, Turton scab. Rushed at him, belting him about the head and face. As Bill turned to front him, Turton walked away, bleeding from the face, ear and head. Bill went and laid upon his bed. A few moments later, Constable John Willett checked out the scuffle and determined this was a savage assault. He took Bill's statement and got his wounds tended. Turton came around when Bill returned home and apologized. After this conversation, Bill spoke with the police, trying to drop the charges. The reason he gave was he had always been on good terms with Turton. However, the police wouldn't let the charges be withdrawn. On the 18th February, Bill saw a doctor. The next night, another man came, late in the evening, saying, You have taken out a summons. then with one punch knocked Bill to the ground, dazing him again. It split the skin under his eye. Bill pulled himself up and punched this man back in self-defense. The police again intervened. This man, late to the party, said withdrawing the case would create peace. He ominously stated,
12 or 14 other unionists are working at the mine.
Bill had been working at the Brown Coal Mine for over 3 years. Recently, he had been on strike with the rest of his union members. However, on the 5th of February, 1921, he chose to return to work. He was friends with these people who were affected by the heightened tensions, trying to fight for better conditions. On the same day as Bill's assault, there had been a second assault to a different man. However, it occurred in precisely the same manner, including having run into Edith, who also called him a scab. Almost like she was the lookout. On the 25th of February, the cases went to court. There was great public interest. The public stalls were full. Everyone I discussed the case with also were greatly intrigued. Our judges and jurors said, I would not uphold the charge of obscene language because it's pathetic to be offended by language unless someone means to insult you. Another anonymous supporter said, so both were punches to the face. Then 2 years minimum imprisonment, just because, again, assault to the head area should be considered as attempted murder, because that is what it can lead to. When Police Magistrate A.A. Kelly dealt with this case, he said, I suspect intimidation was the reason Bill tried to withdraw the charges, mainly because Turton said to the constable, this is a nice thing for you to do. You have laid a charge against me. You ought to withdraw it. And since 2 days after that, Bill was assaulted again. The charge of offensive language against Edith was discussed at length by the defense and police magistrate. In the end, they determined there was no evidence to show the word scab was an abusive term. The police magistrate admitted it was not a term of endearment, and that Bill, as a free and independent man, had the perfect right to go to work as he did without being abused in a public place. The defense said there was no evidence the words were spoken. The police magistrate dismissed the charge against Edith. Police Magistrate Kelly imposed a £3 fine on Turton and a £5 fine on the man who was late to the assault. Magistrate Kelly explained his sentencing by saying, I took into consideration the fact that both men had served for an extended period in World War I. However, if any of your comrades come before me again in this court on a similar charge, they will be severely dealt with and not have the option of a fine. I hope today's proceedings will be a warning to you both and others, and that in the future you will not coerce, abuse, or assault men because they saw fit to accept work offered to them. That put to rest this case. However, it did not discuss or implicate if the union action was necessary. This will be explored in the Yalorn episodes. When we discuss the conditions and safety concerns raised by the union and negotiated with the State Electrical Commission. A very quick spoiler. A cursory search of the deaths at work has many results. Let's move metaphorically to the Easting Camp. It is no longer publicly accessible. Just a reminder, this is where men lived while working and waiting to be reunited with their families. There were a few married people's accommodations, but much less than single men's accommodation. On Tuesday, 8 May 1923, the mess secretary entered his office to find the iron safe holding £300 missing, the wooden floorboards exposed. Superintendent Potter, chief of the criminal investigation at Russell Street, that is the Russell Street in Melbourne, assigned Detective Grieve, who suggested to drag the Yarra River. This was when the blown carcass of the safe was recovered, on Saturday, 12 May 1923. It was believed the robbery was a work of particularly audacious thieves who visited the Brown Coal Mine in a motor vehicle. On another occasion, the darkest time of night, just before dawn broke, when the stableman who resided close to the bulk store heard his dog barking, he bolted out of bed, shouting, "Who's there?" believing he would catch a chaff thief. You know, chaff, the stuff they feed the horses. He looked around the stable to find nobody. Not even his dog was in there with the horses. He went looking for his dog as the daylight broke over the camp. He was surprised to find the state savings bank safe with £300 dropped in the middle of the road. The burglars hadn't even attempted to open it. On the 17th of July 1921, after a full accounting of the store, a few more items are identified as stolen. So these criminals never seem to appear before a magistrate for these crimes. So I don't know the outcome. However, a safecracker in New South Wales in 1924, caught red-handed, was sentenced to 5 years of penal servitude. Ed worked as a labourer and owned a store in the Brown Coal Mine. It's likely his wife B managed the store, where she sold menswear, pipes, shoes, groceries, and possibly whips. She performed the home duties while the store was quiet. After all, it was just out the back. Throughout 1924, B was harassed by Peter. He would show up drunk and talk to her with quote-unquote filthy language, likely propositioning her and then calling her horrible names when she refused. They never did say, but that's classic harassment. Peter annoyed Ed on the occasions he saw him. On New Year's Eve 1925, Peter was outside their shop, shouting obscenities at Ed. Ed came flying out of the store, cracked a whip, striking Peter, dropping him to the ground. Ed then stepped in and kicked Peter in the chest while he was down. Peter was arrested and taken to see a doctor, who said he had two broken ribs. Ed was also arrested. What happens when a small business owner who cracks a whip fronts court? Peter ended up leaving the district before the court case in February 26. However, the Crown still prosecuted the assault. Ed admitted to the assault of Peter. He represented himself and he explained how Peter had been harassing his wife. The police magistrate had a lot to say before imposing the sentence. There is no doubt there are some grounds for taking the law into your own hands, but at the same time, you did not have the right to do so. In America, there is what is called the unwritten law, but that is not desirable in Australia. You could have informed the police and had Peter charged. Even if you only struck him one blow, the matter, under the circumstances, may have been overlooked. But to put the boot in and kick him when he was down is not British. It is not fair play. That sort of thing cannot be tolerated. The police magistrate imposed a £5 fine and ordered £2 and some change in court costs. This next case occurs 2 years later, when two friends walked beside the road with a gun they'd just bought from a returned soldier. Forming one line as a car passed, his friend walked behind him, decided to scare the car by shooting the pistol into the air. Only no bullet discharged into the sky. Confused, he brought the gun down. Citing the problem, the engaged safety mechanism. That was an easy fix. He flicked the switch.
Oh!
The missile lodged in the lower back of his friend. He panicked. He took his friend to the policeman's office. The policeman asked, "What's wrong with your mate?" "I shot him." "How'd that happen?" He relayed the story to the policeman. "Please help him." The policeman drove the young man to the hospital where they removed the bullet, allowing a full recovery. What happened at court when the safety feature backfires? Well, nothing, for the bad safety release timing resulted in accidentally shooting his friend. However, the man was found guilty of having an unregistered gun and in 1928 fined £25.